Thanks for joining us, everybody. This is Warren Hebert with the Home Care Association of Louisiana. We certainly have had a pace of change that's unprecedented in any of our lifetimes. And that change is happening in our day-to-day lives. Certainly, it's happening from a business perspective as well. Clinical changes, regulatory reimbursement changes, issues related to PPE, related to staffing, et cetera. So in an effort to try to keep you on the front end of information in the midst of all of this very rapid pace of change, we had a phone conference last week with Pam Womack, and that was recorded. Today's conference is with Chris Johnston. Chris is an attorney. He has worked in the home health space for many, many moons, and we are very fortunate that he's agreed to do a series of programs for us around some of the legal challenges, some of the regulatory changes, et cetera. So with no further ado, Chris, thank you so much for doing this for us. We really look forward to our relationship with you over the coming weeks as we try to get as much information out as we can related to these significant changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Warren, and good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for attending this. As everybody knows, this is a changing paradigm. These rule changes are happening quickly. I want to thank Richard and Warren for keeping everybody up to date. We have in front of us the interim final rule. It hasn't been sent to the Federal Register yet by CMS. It has a comment period to there, but this is, again, brand new. Nobody has much experience in what's happening, and these rule changes are reflected to pretty much address the situation we're facing. For those of you in the front line, God bless you. Stay safe. But with that said, what we're going to talk about this afternoon are the Medicare and Medicaid programs and policy and regulatory revisions, which were issued just 2 days ago by CMS to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. These final rules, if you have my handout, and if you don't, you could get that from the Home Care Association of Louisiana, and please contact them if you would like to get the PowerPoint handout. But the interim final rule with comment period essentially sets forth some changes that affect a lot of different providers, not only home health and hospice, but it does affect our industry as well. Most of the changes that they're advocating are unfortunately not reimbursement changes, but they do expand upon the use of technologies and telehealth devices in providing home health services. The regulations will be sent, as I said, to the Federal Register. And ultimately, once they're published, there'll be a 60-day period to comment on those. And I know our president, Richard McMillan, has invited everybody to read those proposed regulations. And if you do have comments, to send those in or send them to Warren and maybe through HCLA, we could get those things submitted to the extent that we would like to have any of these changes made permanent or otherwise want to make sure that we have a good understanding of what's being implemented. Not only do the rule changes that CMS is proposing for home health and hospice are advocating a lot of telehealth, one of the rule changes also goes towards the licensing rules here in Louisiana that would allow not only physicians to order home health services, but also physician assistants, advanced practice registered nurses, certified nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, and certified nurse midwives. Governor Edwards, in the end of March, on March 31st, issued a proclamation that expanded who could order and certify and recertify home health to the mid-level practitioner. So in addition to telehealth, that is another significant change in these Medicare rules. If you have any comments in the PowerPoint, I have given the name of the head of the home health division at CMS, who is the author or the principal person responsible for these changes. Her name is Hillary Loeffler. Her number is in the PowerPoint presentation. So if there are any questions that you may have, I'm sure she's swamped just like everybody else in the front line. But her number is 410-786-0456. Or you can contact them for email at homehealthpolicy@cms.hhs.gov. Or if you're a hospice, at hospicepolicy@cms.hhs.gov. So what are these interim proposed rules that we received? It's about a 90-some page document. The first part of the rules is dedicated to the current telehealth and telemedicine services that are available under CMS. And these mostly apply to the physicians and to the physician fee schedule. They have extended a lot of those services to other areas which were previously not reimbursable by Medicare for telemedicine. So there's a boon there or further opportunities to provide services through telehealth. Again, the whole impetus of these regulations is for everybody to keep stay at home, to stay isolated, and to provide services through these telecommunication devices. So to the extent that, you know, your physician partners, your medical directors, or physicians that you know are unaware of these rules, you know, feel free to share them with your physician partners so that they are aware that even a lot of the E&M evaluation and maintenance rules, management rules, can be done now through telehealth devices. So that's the first part of the IFC, is primarily devoted to all the new CPT codes that can be used, which were not previously reimbursed by Medicare, but now are for physicians. One of the important areas in the IFC is they also expand what communication devices are acceptable. Initially, when I spoke for Dr. Collado with the LSBME, we were under the impression, and it made perfect sense, that any platform that was used had to be HIPAA compliant. But because of the enormity of the crisis that we're facing in the IFC, the CMS has waived all that, and pretty much all telecommunication devices are now acceptable, including Facebook and Skype. I understand Zoom is somewhat compromised now, but those other very easy to use software programs are acceptable. In fact, the proposed language change in the CMS rule reads, for the duration of the public health emergency, interactive telecommunication system means any multimedia communications equipment that includes, at a minimum, audio and video equipment permitting two-way, real-time, interactive communication between the patient and distant-site physician or practitioner. So that would be your FaceTime on your cell phone. Skype would do it too. They're both of ways are two-way, real-time, interactive communication services. So that was certainly an extreme help on especially a lot of patients that don't have or who might be elderly will not have the sophistication to operate more complicated platforms. Along those lines, the IFC also has a language concerning what HIPAA, the Office of Civil Rights, is going to waive or decline at this point in time to exercise any enforcement against any potential violations for healthcare providers that are in good faith through everyday communications or are communicating with patients, which could potentially be a violation of HIPAA. They're going to use their discretion and waive penalties, and they specifically use the terms of FaceTime or Skype during accessible vehicles for communicating with patients. For more information from the Office of Civil Rights, in the handout, I do have their link. I'm not going to give it to you over the phone. It's fairly lengthy, but on the handout, at the page 8 of the handout, there is a link to the Office of Civil Rights webpage so that you could go there and make sure you could see all the details concerning the waiver of their enforcement activities. Another important rule change, obviously because we're going to have to offer these telehealth services, is that there were previous fraud alerts and advisory opinions from the OIG that giving free telehealth and free devices and free pages and things of that sort could trigger a civil monetary penalty. And I'm sure you all know that a civil monetary penalty can be enforced if any beneficiary or Medicare patient is induced to select a provider by offering them something of value to select that provider. But here, because of the pandemic, on March 17th, the OIG issued a policy statement that it will not subject practitioners to any sorts of administrative sanctions for arrangements where free or discounted telehealth services are being provided to the beneficiaries. But it has to be that the practitioner reduces or waives the cost-sharing obligations that they that they may owe for the health telehealth services, and they have to be furnished during the COVID-19 declaration period, during this public health emergency. So as long as it's provided during this and does not extend beyond that, then the OIG is saying they will not impose any civil monetary penalties for any reduction or waiving of any cost sharing obligations. And if you provide a free telehealth services, they will not view that as any type of inducement that would trigger a civil monetary penalty. So those are key rule changes that would enable everybody to offer free telehealth services to patients so that they could then remote in and not have nurses go over there to their homes. Now the next part of the IFC is what I guess is affects us the most. It's the clarification of homebound status under the Medicaid home health benefit. There's a couple pages in the IFC that is devoted to if there's any changes to what would be considered as homebound. As we know, homebound is somewhat of an amorphous term, somewhat of a gray area, and, you know, leaving the home with a taxing effort. We've all kind of been there. They're adding additional two, I guess, factors to determining whether someone is homebound or not, and that is when a physician has determined that it's medically contraindicated for a beneficiary to leave the home because he or she has either a confirmed or a suspected diagnosis of COVID-19, or where the physician determined that it's medically contraindicated because the beneficiary is more susceptible to a COVID-19 infection. They specifically have in the proposed regulations that any patient who's exercising self-quarantine for that patient's own safety would not be considered confined to the home, and that the physician certification of the medically contraindicated situation, either because of a confirmed or suspected diagnosis or because of the susceptibility of the patient to be infected, is required in order for there to be a homebound status. They give an example of what they believe is medically contraindicated in the rules. They insist that, of course, and we would know this, that the medical record documentation must include the information as to why the individual condition of the patient is such that leaving the home is medically contraindicated. So in that vein, the rules allow us to not only use the individual situation, but the locale of the individual and other public health management assessments. So, for example, if the individual is in New Orleans and is in an area where neighbors, family members have been infected, and that they also have a condition that would require them, because maybe they have diabetes or one of those other medical conditions that have been identified as making somebody more susceptible to the disease, then that would be considered to be medically contraindicated and they would meet the homebound status. The example that is given in the regulations is this: a patient has exacerbation of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, they have COPD, and the physician certifies that it's medically contraindicated to leave the home because the patient's compromised respiratory system makes him or more likely to contract the infectious disease, they would be considered to be confined to home. So, again, you know, the diabetes, the, I think high blood pressure was another one, COPD, obviously, also fragile, elderly, all of those criteria that have been listed as being geared towards, you know, one having a more likelihood of contracting the infection should be listed in the documentation to justify the homebound status. Despite all these good words they have in the rulemaking authority about what easier to meet homebound status, they still give a warning that the patient still must meet all other Medicare home health eligibility requirements to receive the Medicare home health services. So you still have to be under the care of a physician. You still have to have a plan of care. It's got to be established and reviewed by the physician. You still have the need for the skilled nursing care or the PT or speech therapy or occupational therapy. So they have not simply done away with any of the core requirements for home health. You still have to meet all of those. And for hospice, obviously, you still have to be terminally ill and all of that. So none of that has changed. What has changed is they just simply said, well, if you're susceptible to a coronavirus infection because of your having these other diagnoses, then that could be used in the medical documentation to justify a homebound status. They do say, for example, that for it to be a skilled service, simply going in to test the patient in and of itself is not a skill, a nursing skill, so that would not be something that would meet home health criteria. The most important, I guess, factor is the part of the IFC that promotes the use of telehealth for our industry. I know that Mr. McMillan yesterday or the day before spoke to the difficulties that the home health industry is facing because the rule is actually set in the law, the Social Security Act, that in order to be reimbursed, a home health visit has to be a face-to-face visit, and it cannot be supplanted by a telehealth visit. So, unfortunately, even though they're advocating quite extensively in the rules the use of technology, it's still statutorily prohibited for paying for a home health service that's furnished via a telecommunication system. It cannot be used as a substitute for the in-person home health service. So unfortunately, even during the duration of this public health emergency, there are not going to be any reimbursement changes, or we cannot substitute any of the scheduled visits with a telehealth visit. They are, however, amending the regulations to provide some flexibility to the use of telehealth and telecommunication systems. In particular, they are amending the regulations. There's 42 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 409.43A, This is your standard, one of your conditions of participation, and it concerns your plan of care requirements, and it's being amended on an interim basis. And basically it says that there's now the ability to use technology, in other words, a telehealth system, however, it has to be within the plan of care, and the use of the telehealth device must be related to the skilled services that are currently being furnished by the nurse, and it's used to optimize the services furnished during the home visit or when there is a home visit. So it's an ancillary service. It has to be used in conjunction with the ongoing services. And again, like I said before, it cannot be used as substitute for an in-person visit. The plan of care has to be included in the 485. The use of the telehealth technology must be included in the 485, and there has to be a description of how the use of such technology will help to achieve the goals outlined in the plan of care, and how that is not that the use of the telehealth device is not a substitution for an in-person visit. So to the extent that we have to go back and amend any of the 485s to state that now some of these monitoring will be done through telehealth, then we should do so. And again, you got to tie it back to how that facilitates the skilled service and how it's complementary as opposed to an isolated novel use. Again, just as a reminder, the plan of care just has to be signed before submitting the final claim, so that there's time to go back and change these and get the physician to re-sign those. If we need to incorporate the use of technology into these plans of care. So that's the actual rule reads as follows. And of course, I hate to bore you guys, but this is how they've read the change to the plan of care requirements in the Code of Federal Regulations. The plan of care must include the identification of the responsible disciplines and the frequency and duration of all visits, as well as those items listed in 484.60 of this chapter that establish the need for such services. All care provided must be in accordance with the plan of care. During the public health emergency, and this is the new part, is defined in section 4200, which defines what a public health emergency is, the plan of care must include any provision of remote patient monitoring or other services furnished via telecommunication system, and such services must be tied to the patient-specific needs as identified in the comprehensive assessment. They cannot substitute for a home visit ordered as part of the plan of care, and cannot be considered a home visit for the purposes of patient eligibility or payment. The plan of care must include a description of how the use of such technology will help to achieve the goals outlined on the plan of care. So it looks like it's more work, but no reward. Benefit for the use of the technology, at least according to what they're stating in the rule, is that the use of technology may result in changes to the frequency or types of visits outlined in the plan of care. They give this example, which I'll read out of the IFC directly. It says, a patient recently discharged from the hospital after coronary bypass surgery was receiving home health skilled nursing visits 3 times a week for medication management, teaching, and assessment. The patient developed a fever, cough, sore throat, and moderate shortness of breath, and now has a confirmed COVID-19 diagnosis, which the doctor has determined can be safely managed at home with home health services. The patient has been prescribed new medications for symptom management and oxygen therapy to support the patient's respiratory status. The patient's home health plan of care was updated to include an in-person skilled nursing visit once a week to assess the patient and to monitor for worsening symptoms. The plan of care was updated also to include a video consultation twice a week between the skilled nurse and the patient for medication management, teaching, and assessment, as well as to obtain oxygen saturation readings that the patient relays to the nurse during the consultation. With regards to payment under the home health PPS program, if the primary reason for home health care is to provide care to manage the symptoms resulting from COVID-19, this 30-day period of care would be grouped into the medication management, teaching, and assessment respiratory clinical group, and it would be an early 30-day period of care with an institutional admission source. The rules go on to say, assuming a medium functional impairment level with low comorbidities, the low utilization payment adjustment, your LUPA threshold, would be 4 visits. Regardless, if the patient continued to receive the original 3 in-person skilled nursing visits per week, 12 visits totaling the 30-day period, rather than the once per week in-person skilled nursing visits, which are the 4 visits total in the 30-day period, the home health would still receive the full 30-day payment amount rather than paying per visit if the total number of visits was below the LUPA threshold. In this example, the use of technology is not a substitute for the provision of in-person visits as ordered in the plan of care, as the plan of care was updated to reflect the change in the frequency of the in-person visits and to include virtual visits as part of the management of the home health patient. So, as you can see, these rules contain a lot of encouraging words favoring telehealth, but really at the end of the day, the law hasn't changed, and CMS will only pay for a visit as an episode of personal contact with the beneficiary by staff of the home health or others under arrangement with the home health for the purpose of providing a covered service. So, again, even though there's a lot of advocacy for telehealth, there's not any extra money for it at this point in time. Obviously, the extra cost for telehealth can be put into your cost report, but that's about the only direct reimbursement payment that can be derived from these rule changes. I know Mr. McMillan advocated that part of the goal for NAC and HCLA and all the other home care associations is to remove the requirement that all reimbursable visits have to be in person and for a more creative use of telehealth. But until that happens, unfortunately, we're dealing with what we have with us. Insofar as hospice is concerned, there have been a couple of changes as well, and that's in section 418, 42 CFR 418, again, for certification of the terminal illness. They now allow the use of telehealth during this period of public health emergency to certify or recertify a plan of care. But again, they have the same criteria that it cannot substitute for an in-person visit. They also require that just as in home health, the use of technology must be included in the plan of care and must be tied to the patient's specific needs as identified in the comprehensive assessment. So, again, same as in for home health. The rules also give an example of how telehealth can be used in a hospice setting. And I hate to bore you guys again, but let me just read the example to y'all. It's a example of a terminally ill 85-year-old male with heart failure. They're receiving hospice. He developed, just like in the home health example, the fever, sore throat, and cough. He's been diagnosed with suspected COVID-19. And so now the hospice plan of care has to include medications for symptom management. He's mildly short of breath and does not require supportive oxygen therapy, but there's a concern for the potential worsening of cardiac and respiratory symptoms as a result of the increased complications due to COVID-19. So, again, just as for home health, the hospice plan has been updated to include remote patient monitoring with a telecommunication system to assess the patient's weight and oxygen saturation levels. And then the plan of care should identify interventions if whatever the oxygen saturation levels, if they don't meet whatever the required levels are, that an intervention has to occur. So again, the remote patient monitoring allows for more expedited modification to plan of care in response to patient changing needs. But again, there's no reimbursement for this telehealth device is being used because, again, hospices are paid a per diem based on the level of care for each day that patients under a hospice election, and there is no payment beyond the per diem amount for the use of technology and the hospice benefit. So for the purpose of the hospice claim submission, only in-person visits should be reported on the claim. However, hospices, again, just like home health, can report the cost of telecommunication technology on their cost report as other patient services. There is a thumb relief, however, and I don't know, because I'm not aware of any national coverage determinations or local coverage determinations that have this mentioned in their articles, but the rules do state that during the duration of the public health emergency, any requirement that is found in a national coverage determination by one of the Medicare administrative contractors or a local coverage determination that requires a face-to-face or in-person encounter for evaluations, assessment, certifications, or other implied face-to-face services would not apply. So if it's in the rules, it still applies, but if the face-to-face requirement is in a national or local coverage determination, then the proposed rules would effectively terminate that requirement. But again, I am not aware of any local or national coverage determination that requires that. Maybe an oxygen therapy, but again, I'm not aware of any at this point in time. In addition to the interim final rules with comment period, the IFC, the CMS also issued a summary of those rules. It's called the CMS Flexibility, Home Health Agencies, CMS Flexibilities to Fight COVID-19. I think Warren will have copies of these in case you want these memos as well. It's found on the CMS website. But the summary, which most of these are in the IFC, but just to summarize the different areas of rule change, these are the areas, just to summarize again. So they've expanded for the use of telehealth for home health. Again, not reimbursable, but again, it's still something that can be used, and maybe it's a stepping stone to changing the reimbursement rules down the road. They somewhat expanded the definition of homebound status by allowing those people who are symptomatic or who are susceptible to an infection to be granted homebound status. The mid-levels, this is an important change. Mid-levels can now order home health, sign the plan of care, and certify and recertify the patient eligibility. So that's an important improvement. They've extended the OASIS completion deadline from 5 to 30 days. And if you're late in submitting those, CMS is saying that you will not be penalized. Initial assessments under 42 CFR 48455 can be performed remotely or by record review because that is not a reimbursable event. So they allow you to do that through telecommunications devices. They're saying that MACs will be encouraged to extend any auto cancellation dates for RAPs. They are stating that deadlines are extended for any redetermination or reconsideration appeals, but I have not seen what the extension is, how many days would those be. But to the extent that you have any appeals that are pending or any redetermination or reconsideration requests, apparently they're saying that you have extra deadlines, but I have not seen, again, how much extra time you do have. If you're currently facing an ADR, CMS is saying that that providers will be given more time to respond to these ADR requests. Again, I have not seen anything specifically stating how much more time you'll get. They're also stating that if you are, if you need to file an appeal, but for whatever reason, you can't meet all the procedural requirements, or if you're missing a part of the medical records or part of the documents you need to submit, submitted anyway, and your appeal will not be dismissed, categorically, that they will be more flexible in receiving and considering appeals. Another important feature, I should have mentioned this a lot earlier because it is an important change to the rules, and it would maybe helpful in addition to the Small Business Administration loans that are being made available. The CMS will facilitate access to accelerated advance payments. So if your submitted request meets the, and if you qualify and meets appropriate criteria, they have expedited the time frame for CMS to consider the request, or for the MAC to consider the request, and they're saying that they will shoot for payment in 7 days to you. So you could get an accelerated payment for 7 days, and I think it's 3 days. It's a 3 month reimbursement is how much you could get. Their start repayment date is extended from 920 days, and then I think you have 200 some all days for home health to pay it back. But I think there's another memo, maybe another talk can be had on specifically on this issue, since it is would probably be very important to all your providers. Anybody who's currently under a request for a revalidation, that's being suspended, so no new revalidation actions. Also, if any one of you has submitted a new 855 or any new enrollments, and I guess you wouldn't be here if you haven't enrolled in as a home health yet, but those would be expedited. And the final change that I have seen is that cost report deadline. So if you're in October, end of October, end of November, fiscal year end, and your cost report will be due either in March or April, you now have until the end of June to submit your cost report. Likewise, if your fiscal year end is in December, you have until July of this year to submit your cost report. On a final note, again, they do the warning, and it's kind of like it's just a bit of a pushback, but they say that, you know, if the home health nurse is simply taking a sample for testing, you're certainly allowed to do that, but that is not a skilled visit. So they're encouraging people to take tests and to get tested, but then they tell you, but we're not going to pay for it at the end of the day. So that, in a nutshell, are the changes to the Medicare regulations, the interim final rule and waivers can be found at the CMS.gov website. I believe I know that Warren and Hicklow does have copies, and I'm sure if you ask, they'd be happy to send those to you. So that is something that you could read for yourself. But in essence, that's those are the rule changes, and that is what is contained in that. In those proposed rules. So with that, I've kind of finished the presentation. I know I went very, very quickly through all of them, and so that now we have some time to discuss these. Again, this is all new to everybody. Nobody has experienced this before. So to the extent that somebody has more information on any of these particular points, please share. That would be a benefit to everybody. So thank you for listen to me, and hopefully I didn't bore you all too much.
Thank you, Chris. It's a lot of information, and this is only one piece of a dozen or so major changes. So thank you for doing this. We're going to go ahead and offer any of you that would like to ask questions of Chris, anything that you need as far as more information. Chris, thanks for being willing to take some questions.
Absolutely.
we'll go ahead and you know, give you guys one more opportunity if somebody has something you'd like to ask. If not, you can certainly send questions to either Liz at hclamet.org or to me, Warren at hclamet.org. And as I indicated a little earlier, this is the second of a series of opportunities that we'll have to provide you some education related to the multitude of changes that we've got going on. One more offering for any questions that you might have.
Let me just also add this, Warren, again, is Chris. At the end of the interim final rule, the last couple of pages are probably the best read if you don't want to read through all the minutiae of the reasoning behind the different things. The end actually has the language of the proposed change for each one of those regulations that we talked about. So if you want to just scroll down to the very end of the IFC, you can just go directly to those sections of the regulations that are being changed, and you can read exactly what the language is there. Again, I mean, they're certainly advocating the use of telecommunication systems, but there's no obviously there's beneficial for everybody to use those, but at this point in time, there's no monetary incentive to do so, just because of the law being what it is. But I think they're certainly, hopefully, with what Mr. McMillan is saying, some impetus now to get that changed.
Great. Chris, thank you. We certainly appreciate all you've done for home health over the years, and obviously there's still a lot of work for us to do. Just want to
Absolutely.
Encourage everyone out there. I want to encourage you all to be safe. Social distancing is still the protocol for us. And for those of you that are out providing care, you know, God bless you and be safe. Please let the Home Care Association of Louisiana know if there are issues that you're running into that we can be helpful with. Thanks very much. And again, thanks, Chris Johnson. We appreciate you. Have a good day.
Thank you, everybody, and stay safe.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.